The Cerberus Armory was quite likely the best-stocked and thoroughly outfitted weapon stockpile in post-nuke America. Stacked wooden crates and boxes filled with ammunition lined the walls. Glass-fronted cases held racks of automatic assault rifles. There were many makes and models of subguns, as well as dozens of semi-automatic pistols, complete with holsters and belts. There was also heavy assault weaponry like bazookas, tripod-mounted 20mm cannons, mortars, and rocket launchers. All the ordnance had been laid down in hermetically sealed continuity of government installations before the nuke cost. Protected from the ravages of the outraged environment, nearly every piece of munitions and hardware was as pristine as the day it was first manufactured. Lakesh himself put the arsenal together over several decades, envisioning it as the major supply depot for a rebel army. The army never materialized, at least not in the fashion Lakesh hoped it would. Therefore, Cerberus was blessed with a surplus of death-dealing equipment that would have turned the most militaristic baron green with envy, or given the most pacifistic of them heart failure, if they indeed possessed hearts.
What else did you tell him about Cerberus?
Anything and everything he wanted to know. I owe him that much.
And what about the people back in Cerberus? What do you owe them?
The general couldn't harm them, even if he wanted.
He could harm them by harming us. Just a couple of days ago, I was used as a pawn in someone else's game. I don't think I feel like cooperating with another.
It's not a game.
A game. The Warlord's Gambit. His own words, Nora. He's dragging us into a revolution against, as far as we know, the lawful governing body of this country.
General Zhao Tzu is the rightful ruler of this part of Cambodia. It's by right of descent. His father and his father's father held the title. But now people from the Devi Naga's territory have been slipping away to join him, because they find they cannot live under her dictatorship, and that of Colonel Puyang.
What makes you think General Zhou Tzu doesn't want to be a dictator himself?
He believes in a fairly democratic form of government. I have seen it at work. He commands justly and well.
You sound like a convert to a religion, Nora. Or a woman in love. Oh, for the love. You're infatuated with the man, but you don't know him.
Neither do you.
I know men like him. Outlaws. Hunted men without scruple, doing whatever they think is necessary to survive.
Are you describing the general or yourself?
You don't understand the backstory of the struggle, of the political situation here.
Politics is politics throughout the world.
You met him less than a week ago, and you've already promised that Cerberus would help him overthrow this Devi Naga?
She promised me nothing, Mr. Kane.
Glancing over his shoulder, he saw Zhou Tzu standing beside Nora. His long black hair was tucked back under his straw hat. He was dressed very much like Kane.
It sounds to me like you gave her a hell of a sales pitch. Or was it easier than that? Did you just take advantage of the fact that she was vulnerable and grateful to a man whom she thought saved her life?
Zhou Tzu's face remained as immobile as if it were carved from amber.
I told Miss Pennock the truth. That is all.
Which I sure as hell don't understand, so how could she? How can you maintain a military hereditary rank in a state of war while observing a hereditary truce with your enemy? What kind of war can you wage that way, General?
Zhou Tzu's lips moved in a cryptic smile at Kane's sarcastic emphasis on his rank.
You would be surprised, Mr. Kane, at the number of foes I war with here. Laotian and Thai bandits, tribes of bottom feeders. It is my duty, my role, my purpose in life, to guard the borders of this land. The Devi Naga's traditional role is to preside over the holy city of Angkor Thom and safeguard the gift of the Naga.
Kane scowled, repressing the urge to ask about the tribes of bottom feeders.
What's the gift of the Naga?
It's part of the mythology, the religious lore here. The temple tomb complex of Angkor Wat was built over a site that contains the Naga's essence, kept in harmonic balance. It was never to be trifled with or put out of balance, else all of humankind would suffer.
Yes, a corollary myth would be that of Pandora.
Are you trying to tell me there's a magic box under the city?
Actually, in the original Greek myth, it was a beautiful golden urn given to Pandora by the gods as a wedding gift. Her husband, Epimetheus, warned her never to open it. But eventually, human curiosity got the better of her. She prized up the lid of the urn and released lust, greed, hatred, and all of the other sins upon humankind. She closed the lid in time to keep hope at the bottom, to compensate us for the evil that men do.
He lifted his hands, holding them palms up at the same level.
Thus, the balance between yin and yang to which I referred yesterday is achieved.
Too damn bad you didn't rescue Bridget, too. She'd be right at home listening to this lecture.
I mentioned I was an educated man.
Oh, you are far more than that, my general.
Kane's stomach slipped sideways at the tone of worship in Nora's voice, but Josu didn't react to her comment.
It is the balance I seek to restore, or my land will be plunged into bloodshed and civil war. Easy prey for our other enemies once they learn of our internal discord.
What are you talking about with the essence of the Naga? The earth energies you told me about?
The ancient Khmer lived in Angkor Thom with the ability to manipulate them, maintaining them in harmonized balance. Most of that knowledge was lost over the centuries, and I speculate that was the main reason the Khmer Empire disappeared. I think their fortunes took a turn for the worse when the essences of the Naga slipped out of balance.
Kane leaned against the rail, crossing his arms over his chest. His irritation was slowly being subsumed by interest.
I don't know how much I believe about geomancy, but could there be a machine under the place, or is it strictly a natural phenomenon?
I surmise a bit of both.
It's possible a machine of sorts was constructed to channel the earth energies and to keep them in balance, in sync. My role as warlord and Kumudvati's as the Devinaga are expressions, physical manifestations of that balance. The effulgence of the Sudarshana chakra, or the supreme personality of Godhead. I admit the roles are largely theater, to keep an ancient tradition alive. Even though my line of descent is traced to the offspring of the first queen and king of Cambodia, legends of men who mated with serpent princesses and founded royal houses are widespread throughout Asia. Kumudvati and I are hardly unique, folklorically speaking. However, a very prominent man of my line, Jayavarman VII, was the Khmer ruler most concerned with his subjects' welfare. He saw to the construction of roads, hospitals, and even healing shrines built over intersection points of the Naga essence.
He sounds like quite a benefactor.
Jayavarman VII was also the Khmer ruler most obsessed with celebrating his own divinity. All of the construction was performed by forced labor, free people pressed into slavery. He enslaved and impoverished the country. Thousands died due to his Olympian ego. Finally, outlying territories revolted, and after a long, bloody struggle, he was deposed. As karmic restitution, male members of his line were charged with the task of opposing the rulers of Angkor Thom, if in principle rather than by actual deed. I am the latest in a long line, perhaps the last.
And Kumudvati, the serpent princess, is she the last in the line too?
I cannot tell you that because I don't know. It is forbidden that we ever meet, since we symbolize opposite poles, yin and yang. However...
However what?
Swiveling his head in the direction of Nora's scream, Kane saw a brown paw glistening with river water and clotted with mud rise up and slap around the side. The long square nails of the webbed fingers were caked with muck and beveled at the edges. General Jotsu stepped swiftly toward Nora, arms sliding protectively around her shoulders. At the same time, he shouted sharply,
"To arms! Bottom feeders!"
Noon brought yet another heavy rain shower to the jungle. The downpour was so intense, the branches of the trees couldn't keep the rain from soaking Bridget through to the skin. Only a few minutes before, she had been grateful that she, Javalara, Yasavar, and the two elephants had left the open farmlands and entered the cool shade of the jungle. Now she huddled down on Maya's back as the tropical rain pounded her, blinding her and making it difficult to breathe without inhaling water. The elephants, on the other hand, were overjoyed by the cooling storm, lifting their trunks and bleating in pleasure. At the very least, the downpour reduced the high level of Maya's stink to the tolerable point.
"We'll reach our Vimana very soon."
The downpour abated as abruptly as it had come. And almost as abruptly, tendrils of mist closed in, as if spewed from the undergrowth. Straightening, Bridget massaged the base of her spine. A dull ache had settled into her lower back and hip joints, making her wonder if she were getting, as Grant often grunted, too old for this shit. She swallowed a sigh of resignation. Riding on an elephant through a rain-soaked Asian jungle was just the latest in a long series of travails she had endured from the time she'd first met Kane. She'd been an archivist for the Baron then, and her eidetic memory had been a hidden blessing as she searched through all the files kept in Cobaltville's historical division. If she saw it, she remembered it. As a trained archivist, though, she knew misinformation often began with half-truths, then grew into speculative transitions as someone worked to record the event. No information was sometimes better than half-information. The primary duty of archivists was not to record pre-dark history, but to revise, rewrite, and oftentimes completely disguise it. The political causes leading to the Nukecost were well known. They were major parts of the dogma, the doctrine, the articles of faith, and they had to be accurately recorded for posterity. The Cerberus database contained unedited and unexpurgated data, and having access to it was one of the few perks Bridget found in her life as an exile. Life in Cobaltville had been predictable, and she sometimes missed the monotony of routine. She knew Grant and Kane often longed for it as well. Their whole lives, from conception to death, were ordered for them, both at work and at home. Ville dogma, Ville upbringing, convinced them how lucky they were to live on the bounty of the Baron, and not to have to scratch out a starvation existence in the Outlands. As long as they obeyed the maddening and contradictory volume of rules, they had security, medical, and even retirement benefits. It was the only life they had known. Now they were forced to live with prices on their heads, which any so-called citizen could collect just by giving information about them, and it was all because they had sinned by trying to learn a truth and develop a concept of a larger destiny. But during her time with Cerberus and her travels and travails, she had learned many people shared her hunger for truth. She counted the Magickers among them. Bridget took a deep breath of the steamy, moisture-saturated air and realized the thin fabric of her garb was plastered tight against her body. At the moment, she didn't care, because breathing in the wake of the storm was like trying to hyperventilate in a sauna on full boil. The path the elephants followed twisted snake-like upon itself through a jumble of trees and vines. More than once, the humans upon their backs were forced to lie almost completely flat to keep from being scraped off by branches. Bridget couldn't help but curse in pain when a thorny vine snagged her shoulder, inflicting scratches. Maya, the elephant, lumbered around a turn and entered a clearing. Huts of wattle, mud, and thatch took shape out of the mist. No one seemed to be around. Javalara and Yasavar halted the elephants and had the big animals bend their forelegs so they could dismount easily. Bridget silently endured the burning pain in her back and pelvis as she slid from Maya's back and dropped to the ground. She felt as if both hip sockets had been replaced by rusty hinges, but she made no complaint. She did, however, favor Brother Yasavar with an icy glare when she caught him eyeing her sari and how the wet cloth clung to her full breasts. He averted his eyes, but didn't seem particularly embarrassed. While his elephant knelt, he took down the crate containing the interphaser and placed it safely to one side. Javalara marched toward the huts.
Follow me, Baptiste.
While Yasavar attended to the elephants, Bridget did as the man requested, carrying the saddlebag slung over her shoulders. She followed Javalara into the largest of the huts. Not surprisingly, the interior was completely bare of furnishings, despite its size. Only a scattering of straw and grasses lay on the hard-packed dirt floor. The sunlight peeping through the cracks in the walls glinted on a circlet of dull metal on the floor. Grasping the ring with both hands, Javalara heaved up on it, a grunt of exertion escaping from between clenched teeth. Bridget stepped forward to help the man, but a metallic clank resounded within the hut, and the Magicker released the ring and rocked back on his heels.
Stand back, Baptiste.
Mystified, Bridget retreated back to the threshold, although as far as she could see, his tugging on the metal circlet had accomplished nothing. Then, with a clanking rumble and a grinding of gears, the entire floor of the hut tipped upward, slowly rotating on hidden, squeaking pivots. The floor turned completely over. As it did, a small teardrop-shaped craft hove into view, clamped securely to the underside by an arrangement of clamps and vices. As the floor completed its rotation, Javalara gestured grandly.
This is the Vimana of the Magickers.
Bridget wasn't impressed. The length and beam of the air cruiser appeared half that of the one that had buzzed them only a couple of hours earlier. She didn't see wings or any apparatus that allowed it to become airborne. The purple-tinted hull was smooth, almost seamless. Peering through the bubble-enclosed cockpit, Bridget saw nothing resembling a conventional control panel either.
I know it doesn't look like much.
That's an understatement and a half. It doesn't look like it can seat more than two.
Three, providing the third person is fairly small, light of weight, and doesn't mind being cramped.
I mind.
Javalara stepped up to the starboard side of the craft, knelt, and ran his hands over the underside of the fuselage.
Do you know how the ancients built their vimanas, Baptiste?
No, not really. Only that they operated on principles that combined the spiritual and the mechanical.
That's very astute. Among the more famous ancient texts that mention vimanas are the Ramayana and Mahabharata. Other lesser-known texts include the Saramangana Sutradhara and the Yuktikalpataru of Bhoja, dating back to the 12th century AD.
There's the Rig Veda, too. Many scholars feel that the tales of the vimanas are the same as the legends of flying carpets.
Possibly. The Samarangana Sutradhara says that they were made of light material with a strong, well-shaped body. Ah, here we are.
He pulled on a small lever, and from either side of the vimana popped ribbed wings made of material that reminded Bridget of a polymer like Dacron or Mylar. They were folded tight against the fuselage, like those of a bat at rest, and like bat wings, they were scalloped on the edges.
According to the text, iron, copper, mercury, and lead were used in their construction. They could fly great distances and were propelled to air by motors. The Samarangala Sutradhara devotes 230 stanzas to the building of these machines and their uses in peace and war. Strong and durable must the body be made, like a great flying bird of light material. Inside it, one must place the mercury engine with its iron heating apparatus beneath. By means of the power latent in the mercury that sets the driving whirlwind in motion, a man sitting inside may travel a great distance in the sky in a most marvelous manner.
Bridget smiled wryly and pulled off her turban, shaking her hair free.
That doesn't sound like any kind of theory of avionics I'm familiar with.
Me either. But the texts say that by using the prescribed processes, it was possible to build a vimana as large as a temple. The Ramayana describes a vimana as a double-deck circular aircraft with portholes and a dome. It flew with the speed of the wind and gave forth a melodious sound.
Sounds like a classic description of the flying saucer or disc. I wonder which came first, the vimana or the flying saucer. The operation of either fits into accepted scientific theory.
Who can say? There is much about our land, its legend and lore, that does not fit with modern scientific theory.
Like the ongoing problem you want my help to solve? The one that deals with, and I quote, the generation, balance, and manipulation of energy?
Yes. In our attempt to solve it, we tried to force it into our perceptions of scientific law. We failed and were banished. But our attempts had an unfortunate result.
Bridget ran her fingers through the tangles in her heavy mane, trying to work them out.
Explain.
Anchor Tome is built upon a convergence of Earth energy lines. Angkor Wat, the palace of the Devinaga, was deliberately constructed over a vortex of geomantic energy. Are you familiar with the term?
Somewhat. The literal meaning of the word geomancy is to divine the Earth. Generally, geomancers believe that the energy of the planet is the very force from which humanity draws its life.
It's also a science, mapping out places where strands of Earth energy join together, forming a power point or a vortex. That's the function of your machine, isn't it?
Despite her many years of working to perfect a poker face, Bridget couldn't completely conceal an expression of astonishment.
How do you know that?
We may wear robes, eat bad food, and use elephants to get around, but we're not completely primitive. There are some among us who have experience with computers, me among them. I took your machine, your interfacer, and downloaded some of its data into a PC we have hidden in a monastery. The information was very illuminating. It confirmed an aspect of the Angkor Wat Vortex I had long suspected.
Which is?
The energy web of the planet is multidimensional. Strands of it travel through space, connecting all things in the universe to one another. The so-called essence of the Naga is a point where the very fabric of dimensional space is distorted, but the distortion was maintained in harmony and balance for many centuries.
And you disturbed the balance?
On the orders of the Devinaga, or at least Colonel Pu Yang claimed the orders came from her, we set into motion a process that allowed the geomantic energy to leak through and accumulate in a vessel, like a giant storage battery. When enough of a charge builds up, the towers vent it.
Vent it? As a wave or a ray or what?
As a field. And as the earth energy is generated, it is carried by the water and wind. Angkor Thom is built around natural and artificial waterways. Our blood interacts with the electromagnetic field, generating the life force within our bodies on a cellular level.
I think I understand your concerns. When the vortex was in balance, any effect on people in the area was negligible. Now that it's out of true, you're afraid it will negatively impact their health, perhaps their minds.
Negative effects have already manifested themselves, else we would not have been exiled. The essence of the Naga, the Sudarshana Chakra, has both positive and negative aspects.
Why do you call the vortex the essence of the Naga?
Are you familiar with the Naga, the serpent folk?
To some extent.
Bridget didn't elaborate on the countless hours of research she had undertaken to learn all she could about the reptilian entities who played pivotal roles in the development of almost all human cultures. For as long as humanity had kept records, there were legends of a mysterious serpent folk descending from the heavens to participate in the creation of humankind. Cultures in places as widespread as of Sumer, Babylonia, China, Japan, and even Central America had myth cycles about these reptilian entities. Serpents, or dragons, signified divine heritage in many Asian countries. The Sumerians called them the Anunnaki, the Hebrews the Agathodaimon, and the Celts the Nufuerlt. Bridget was convinced they were the same race who interacted with different civilizations at different stages in human history.
The Naga, just like humans, have good and bad among them. A group of evil Naga called Panis, Nivatakavakas, Kaleas, and Hiranya were enemies of humanity. They lived in underground halls like snakes. From birth, they were extremely powerful and cruel, and although they were proud of their strength, they were always defeated by the Sudarshana Chakra. They could not disrupt the supreme personality of Godhead.
That made them very angry, so they created many demonic serpents called the Nagaloka. They were all extremely vicious but vain. Their hoods were bedecked with valuable gems, and the light emanating from the gems illuminated their underground abode. But they needed more light, and they sought it from the essence of the Naga.
I see. The vortex symbolizes the positive energy of the Naga and negative energy of the Nagaloka. Both emit light, but the effect is different.
That is substantially it, yes.
Then why were you ordered to alter the balance of the vortex?
Colonel Puyang claimed it was the will of the Devi Naga. She wanted to manipulate the energies beneficially, to use them to reshape and remold our country, to revive the glories of the Khmer Empire. I believe it was his ambition, not hers.
I suspect the same thing, just as I suspect that when we tipped the balance, the change in the radiation tipped Colonel Puyang's mind in the same direction. He was never a good man, bitter, ambitious, petty, but he obeyed our ancient laws. Shortly after our interference with the vortex, his most negative, most rapacious traits came to the fore. When we expressed our intent to return to the vortex and try to rectify our error, he had us exiled.
You were never able to appeal to the Devi Naga directly?
Instead of answering, Jabalara dropped to his hands and knees and crawled underneath the Vimana. Bridget bent and saw him wriggle through a hatch in the craft's belly. A few seconds later, he popped up under the cockpit bubble, appearing to be absorbed by something out of Bridget's range of vision. His eyes closed, and his lips moved slightly as if he were whispering to himself.
What is he...
Shh! Suddenly, so suddenly, Bridget jumped in surprise. The Vimana exuded a faint, strange hum that was a synthesis of a motor and a musical instrument. The clamps released the craft with loud clacks, and the Vimana floated free above the cradle, listing slightly from side to side.
It works!
Of course. We know what we're doing. Well, most of the time. Some of the time.
Now what?
Now we wait until nightfall and fly into the city. Then we will make our way to the palace and...
I don't think so.
Wait. But you promised to help us restore the balance to the essence.
I'm still going to help. But we're not waiting until nightfall. We're leaving now.
Now?
Now! The city will be swarming with people attending the executions.
He broke off when he saw the cold smile lift the corners of Bridget's lips.
You're absolutely right. And we're going to crash the party and save my friend. Or we're not going to do anything at all.
But it's mad.
Oh, the Cobra Guard will be there. It's too risky. It's suicide.
Bridget inserted her hand into the saddlebag and smoothly withdrew her auto pistol. She did not aim it at either of the two men, but her intent was unmistakable.
I say again, or we're not going to do anything at all.
The face leering up at Kane with a maniacal glee was human enough, but the contours of the hairless skull were misshapen, sloping back from the prominent brow so severely there didn't seem to be sufficient capacity for more than a spoonful of brains. The texture and color of the skin looked like wet burlap. The man's mouth was open in a silent laugh, revealing sharp, narrow teeth. As he heaved himself up by his right hand, he menaced Kane with a long dagger in his left. Not thinking, only reacting, Kane kicked him squarely in his open mouth. The man fell back into the river with barely a splash. Kane turned to see a crewman being yanked up from the barge by a rope and noose that had been dropped from the intertwining boughs above. The man shot straight up, clawing at the noose around his throat, disappearing with a crash among the limbs and branches. A naked, brown-skinned man, acting as counterweight, came down on the length of the rope as the crew member went up. The man swept a flat blade in an arc to keep the shocked crewman back. He was a corpulent, toad-like chunk of man, reeking of the swamp. The creature's nape was a thick roll of fat that thrust his head forward aggressively. His eyes gleamed like a pair of wet black pearls swimming in mud. Ornaments fashioned from bones were his only concession to clothing. Kane used his foot as a lever to flip the copperhead up into his hands. His thumb dislodged the safety switch and he pressed the trigger, sending a full auto burst smashing into the toad man, knocking him backward over the prow. As if the gunfire was a signal, the crew ran to and fro across the deck, opening up boxes and crates stacked against the deck housing amidships. Responding to General Zhou Tzu's shouted commands, they handed out weapons, most of them small subguns.
What the hell are bottom feeders?
Zhou Tzu obligingly took the copperhead from Kane.
A tribe of inbred wretches who inhabit the swamps. Pirates and scavengers, they often raid barges like this, seeking both plunder and sport. Nora, get below.
But...
That is an order.
Without another word, she turned on her heel and entered the small cabin. Kane stared after her for a stunned second, then completed securing the Sin-Eater's power holster to his forearm.
Are the bottom feeders muties?
They are adapted to life in and around the river and the swamps. They can hold their breath for a long time underwater. I've encountered them many times. I doubt they would have attacked us except they saw a woman aboard.
Just the concept of a woman like Nora in the hands of the bottom feeders was enough to evoke a surge of nausea in Kane's belly. They reminded him strongly of Swampies, the mutants who haunted the southern bayous. He tensed his wrist tendons and the Sin-Eater slapped solidly into his palm.
Will they be back?
I fear so. They just made a sortie to feel out our defenses and unnerve us. They rely a great deal on their reputations to get what they want.
Within a second of Josu's announcement, the concerted attack came from all sides. A horde of bottom feeders converged on the barge in a rush of naked bodies streaming with foul-smelling water. At least three more dropped from the tree limbs above. One bottom feeder slid down a length of rope made of interbraided grass, a knife gripped between his jaws. His flat feet slammed to the deck where Kane had stood an instant before. Kane lifted his right arm. Three crewmen opened fire with their subguns, full-auto fusillades that smashed into a pair of bottom feeders, knocking them backward over the starboard side. The brown men continued to pull themselves aboard, their flat feet slapping wetly against the deck planks. A sailor went down beneath a bulk of two toad-like bodies, gutted by knives. The copperhead in Josu's hands chattered in a short burst. A bottom feeder spun on his toes, the top of his distorted skull floating away in a red mist. He glimpsed another of his crew, a youth who appeared to be no more than 12, vainly trying to keep a knife from slitting his throat. Zhou Tzu leaped, knocking the knife from the slimy hand with the frame of the copperhead, and then drove the butt full into the bottom feeder's squat throat. Suddenly, another toad-like man dived at the general's back, long dagger in hand.
Thank you, Kane.
Think nothing of it. For now.
The deck of the barge erupted with gunfire, screams, and shouts. Steel-jacketed bullets tore ragged holes in naked brown flesh. More than once, a slug struck splinters uncomfortably close to Kane. He was forced to dodge and duck instead of finding targets. The battle swirled around the housing of the cabin. Zhou Tzu was careful how he handled the copperhead, not hosing the ammo around indiscriminately. All of the rounds he fired found targets, the well-timed and placed bullets knocking another knife-wielding bottom feeder's legs out from under him. He squalled as he fell, toppling overboard with a great splash. Back and forth, the struggle swayed, gunfire crashing, all the combatants howling. The wooden planking underfoot streamed with blood. The barge's crew backed up to the foredeck. The cramped kill zone was packed and jammed with adversaries crushed together breast to breast. The accuracy of the shots fired by Kane and Jotsu finally split the bottom feeder ranks. The surge of toad men reluctantly ebbed back toward the rails in a chaotic, confused swirl of rearguard combat. They retreated stubbornly. A heavy, solid weight bowled Kane off his feet, cannonading him headlong into the port side, knocking almost all the wind from him. Only a last-second frantic grab of the rail kept him from pitching overboard. As it was, his straw hat splashed down into the Siem Rap, but he was too dazed to care much about rescuing his disguise. Trying to drag air into his lungs, Kane pushed himself up and around. A stinking webbed hand stretched out to clamp around his throat. Kane tried to bat it aside and bring his sin eater up, but the bottom feeder's other hand gripped his right wrist. He drove a knee into Kane's groin. Although the blow didn't land squarely, pain flared through his testicles and bile leaped up his throat. Only the hand tightly squeezing his neck kept him from vomiting. Suddenly, the bottom feeder's body jerked violently, and the grip on his hand and wrist loosened. Kane fought free, falling to the deck, dragging in a shuddery lungful of air. A spur of red-stained metal protruded from the man's flabby left pectoral. He touched it, wonderingly. Then his lips peeled back in a vicious grimace. He tried to lock his hands around Kane's throat again, as though the bottom feeder's last conscious wish was to deal death even as he died. Kane brought up the bore of his sin eater. As the brown man fell over sideways, Kane saw Nora standing on the deck, her left hand still tight around the wooden haft of a pike, her face pinched tight with anxiety.
Thanks. But didn't the general tell you to stay below?
They're chopping their way up through the keel. I thought somebody should know.
Kane felt the jarring impacts vibrate the deck beneath his feet, and he swept his gaze over the struggling figures driving the last of the bottom feeders overboard. He glimpsed Jotsu stroking short bursts from his copperhead.
General, those bastards are cutting holes in the bottom.
Jotsu didn't react, his ears filled with gunfire and screams. At that moment, a bottom feeder lunged around the corner of the deckhouse, sweeping up Nora in his arms and bearing her forward. Kane bit back a curse, tracking the warty man with the bore of his pistol. He shifted position, trying to bring the creature into target acquisition without endangering Nora Penick. The bottom feeder was cunning. He knew exactly how to hold Nora to shield his vitals. He reached the rail and paused, one foot propped on it, arms tight around Nora, glaring at Kane in a silent dare. He put a hand around the slender column of her throat, and she grimaced either in pain or disgust. Slowly, Kane lowered the sin eater, and a grin of malicious triumph crossed the man's face. The bottom feeder poised himself to leap overboard. Then the figure of Jotsu appeared on the barge rail, blocking the man's path to the river. Without hesitation, he kicked the brown man in the throat. Gagging, the bottom feeder staggered back, his grip on Nora loosening. Bending her knees, she slid down through his arms and rolled frantically away from the man. Jotsu's focus was on the creature that had attacked her. The bottom feeder raised his hands in supplication. The general fired the copperhead dry, perforating the toad-like man's belly. Jotsu dropped the subgun and advanced on the squealing raider, doubled up around his belly wounds. One of his crewmen handed him a knife a bottom feeder had brandished. Jotsu thrust the blade into the bottom feeder's back. Leaving the knife planted in his spine, he jerked the brown man erect, clutching him by the throat. He forced him backward all the way to the stern. He twirled him around, and with a contemptuous kick to the rear, the general dumped him headfirst into the Siem Rap. Even Kane felt a quiver of unease at the controlled savagery of the man's actions. When Jotsu turned, the expression on his face was one of pure homicidal fury. He marched over to Nora, who Kane was helping to her feet. She winced, cradling her injured arm with her left hand. Grabbing her by the shoulders, the general shook her.
I told you to stay below!
Nora ducked her head, unable to meet the enraged eyes of Jotsu. Kane tensed to insinuate himself between the two people. He half expected to witness a replay of the reunion of Ein and Alf Thoroldsen. Instead, the general hugged her to him in a tight embrace, wrapping his arms around her as if he feared to release her again. Kane felt a sense of shock and even a little shame. Nora Penick might indeed have been a woman in love, but there was no question she was loved in return. One of the crewmen peered into the deck housing and shouted angry, frightened words in Khmer. Jotsu reluctantly released Nora, exchanging a rapid-fire flurry of words with his men. Only two remained on their feet.
We are taking on water. The bastards managed to chop completely through the hull. We have no choice but to abandon ship.
Kane gave the boat a swift visual inspection. Starboard astern was definitely tipping very close to the river surface.
No chance of repairs?
Not without a dry dock. We must go the rest of the way on foot.
It will not be an easy or safe journey.
As if it's been a pleasure cruise so far.
The water, though not cold, was at least a few degrees cooler than the hot, humid air above the Siem Reap. The swim was not a long one, but by the time Kane, Nora, the General, and his three men reached the bank, the barge had filled with water and sunk to the bottom. The bodies of the crewmen and bottom feeders alike bobbed on the surface, carried away by the current. They struggled up the slippery bank, using tree roots to haul themselves out of the river. The six people sat in the shade of palms among a thick growth of ferns to rest. The smell of decaying vegetation blended with that of exotic flowers, which bloomed in crimson, gold, and white against the dark green walls of foliage.
How far do we have to travel?
A half day's march southeast should bring us within sight of the city.
Kane looked up, gauging the position of the sun.
Hell, it's not even noon.
I doubt it's even 11. We can only pray the rest of the day is not as eventful as the morning has been.
I hear that. Let's get moving before more bottom feeders or tigers or dragons show up.
Jotsu permitted himself a small smile.
You fought well, Mr. Kane. All of us would surely have been killed if not for your marksmanship. Thank you.
So far, your gambit hasn't been very successful. And Nora was most definitely on the game board.
I realize that. She acted rashly.
But she saved my life.
Just so. But she acted rashly nevertheless.
I'd like to know what you have in mind once we reach the city.
During my education, I learned some of your country's vernacular. One of the phrases that remained with me all these years was, need to know basis. I'm afraid that information is on a need-to-know basis.
Well, if you want my help, then you had better put it on your need-to-know list.
By the same token, if you want my help, so you can survive the trek through this jungle, then it would be best if you followed my orders. I am in command here, Mr. Kane, not you.
I won't be your pawn, General, and neither will she.
She is not your concern.
Kane locked unblinking eyes with the General, then decided it would be diplomatic to drop the subject. For a time, the General's men hacked a path through the dense tropical undergrowth with machetes they had salvaged from the sinking barge. No one spoke for a long time. There were only the grunts and wheezes of laboring men, the chopping of blades as they sheared through vines and saplings, and the rustle of undergrowth as the small party pushed its way through the jungle. The air was as hot and as steamy as if they were in a hothouse. Sweat glistened on everyone's faces and limbs. Almost no breeze disturbed the sweltering atmosphere. The close-growing palm trees, draped with loops and braids of flowering lianas, proved to be a more than adequate windbreak. The humidity kept their clothes from completely drying, making Kane feel as if he wore a bog. Flying insects hummed above their heads in muggy air. Scarlet-beaked birds cawed at them from the branches of banyan trees. Once Kane sighted a huge python slithering lethargically into the brush, and the back of his neck flushed cold, but the rest of his body stayed hot and sweaty. Suddenly, Jotsu shot out a restraining hand to halt his companions. He tilted his head back, sniffing the air.
What is it?
An odd thing. A fire to our left.
Kane inhaled through his nostrils and detected the odor of burning. He followed Jotsu through a thicket of tall, clattering bamboo. They forged ahead through the labyrinthine tangle of vine and creeper. The ground was very damp underfoot, and Kane wondered what could have possibly caught fire in the swampy jungle. General Jotsu came to a sudden halt, so suddenly Kane nearly trod on his heels. About 50 yards ahead lay a long, torpedo-shaped object, burnished silver in color. Its wings were crumpled against the ground like abstract aluminum foil sculptures.
A Vimana.
A what?
A flying ship.
The craft had crashed into the jungle, and flammables within it had caught fire, but had not burned for very long. The nose of the ruined ship was turned in on itself, charred black, exposing a skeletal framework of metal. Kane estimated the Vimana was no more than 20 feet long. It didn't look very sturdy.
No chance of patching it up for our own use.
He stepped closer, then stopped again.
Do you see that insignia?
Kane eyed the fuselage and made out a symbol that reminded him of a caduceus. Only this one depicted a cobra with seven heads coiled around a pointed column.
Yes? So?
That is the royal seal of the Devi Naga herself. This ship came from the palace.
We better check to make sure there's no one inside.
He had walked only a few feet before their presence was requested in a most direct manner. Jotsu slashed apart vines and brush with the machete.
This way.
Easy. This could be some kind of a trap.
I agree. From what you've told me of your enemies, you can't afford to take chances this close to the city.
Oh, I think not. I've heard a good many genuine screams of fear in my life, and I can tell the false from the genuine.
He started to say more, then came to a halt, lifting the machete, first to bring the people behind him to a stop, and then to point. Kane looked in the direction Jozu indicated. Clinging to the low branch of a gnarled tree by her hands and feet was a small raven-haired girl. Her legs were muddied, and her naked limbs, the color of polished opals, bore angry red lines where thorns had inflicted scratches. Her only clothing was a long silken loincloth. She appeared to be dressed more for bed than the jungle. A giant monitor lizard squatted at the base of the tree and watched the girl unblinkingly. The lizard was larger than the creature Kane had killed on the way to the trading post, its hide the color of molten lead mixed in with patches of milky green. Its long yellow tongue flickered out from between its jaws, darting up toward the treed girl. Apparently, the dragon hadn't tried to heave itself up on its hind legs, else it would easily have seized the girl and yanked her from her perch. As it was, the creature didn't seem overly eager in making the girl a meal, evincing more curiosity than hunger.
I'd hate to waste ammo on another one of those things. Maybe we can chase it off.
Not a good idea. Even a nip from a dragon can be fatal. They have toxic bacteria in their mouths. After it bites its prey, the victim will sicken and die from blood poisoning within a day or two. Then the dragon will scent out the body and eat it.
Lovable. All right, let's do it.
Sin Eater in hand, he and Jozu approached the huge lizard. The general held the copperhead. The dragon uttered a sibilant fluttering noise, the loose flesh at its throat undulating, its eyes still fixed on the girl. Muscles rippled along its hindquarters. Kane guessed the creature was readying itself to rear up. Kane felt he had to do something, and soon.
Hey!
Both the girl and the dragon swung their heads toward him. The dragon inspected them silently. Joe had taken up position near the animal's right flank. The laser autotargeter played the red kill dot along its barrel-shaped body. Jozu shouted to the girl in Khmer. Without the PDA, Kane didn't understand his words, but the girl's response sounded relieved. Her voice was high and quavery, like that of a terrified child.
I shall try for its heart. Mr. Kane, you should concentrate your fire on the beast's brain.
Kane framed the creature's skull within the rear sights of the Sin Eater, cupping his right hand in his left.
On three. One, two, three.
Both men opened up with full auto barrages. The dragon screeched in pain, snapped at the penetration points on its body. Its jaws gaped open like those of a snake, and Kane squeezed off one more shot, the round drilling through the roof of the creature's mouth and into its brain. Then the dragon swayed on its bowed legs and tumbled over sideways. It opened and closed its jaws repeatedly, blood spouting from its nostrils. Its tail, whipping wildly in post-mortem spasms, smashed into the tree, shaking loose a shower of leaves and shearing away a basketful of bark. The girl lost her grip. Jozu dropped the copperhead and bounded forward, managing to catch the girl in his arms before she hit the ground. He swiftly sprinted out of range of the giant reptile's lashing tail. As the monster's convulsing death throes became tremblings, Jozu carried the girl over to Nora and set her upright gently. He spoke to her quietly in Khmer. The girl brushed back her waist-length hair, staring up at him in wonder, and replied in a voice so faint Kane couldn't hear.
What did she say?
The girl's head swiveled toward him, eyes widening in surprise.
English. You speak English like Booster.
Booster? Do you mean Brewster?
The girl turned her head toward her. As she did so, the jungle-filtered sunlight glinted on the delicate gold scale design painted on her eyes.
Another English.
Jozu touched the design on her face carefully, the expression on his face studiedly neutral.
What is your name, child?
I am Kumodvati.
The general's face finally registered emotion, as did Nora's. Their astounded expressions mirrored each other's.
Ridiculous. You are far too young to be the Devinaga.
How would you know?
What are you doing out here?
I became very restless in the palace, cooped up in my rooms. This morning I took the Vimana.
You were allowed to fly it alone, without a pilot?
It is the royal Vimana, and I am the Devinaga. No one allows me to do anything. I just do it.
Kane could tell by the tone and cadence of her voice the girl was lying.
I don't believe you.
The girl drew herself up haughtily, attempting an air of regal indignation.
How dare you challenge the word of the Serpent Princess?
It's easy. You're not my serpent or my princess. The one you called Boo Star is a lost friend of mine. I seek another friend, too. And I know a spoiled kid like you didn't fly out here from your safe palace because you were bored with having your face painted.
Kumudvati's sweeping eyelashes fluttered over dark eyes, suddenly brimming with tears. She buried her face in her hands and began sobbing, her shoulders quaking. Kane exchanged a helpless glance with Jotsu, who then looked pleadingly toward Nora. She put an arm around the weeping girl and led her away from the two men.
It's all right, lass. No need to cry. You're among friends here.
The girl clung tightly to Nora and continued to cry, speaking in Khmer, her voice blurred by sobs. Kane caught Jotsu's jaw muscles bunch in reaction to her words.
What's she saying?
She wants her mother. She misses her mother. Apparently she died some time ago.
I don't want to sound any more cold-blooded than I already have, but we've got no time for this. If she knows the whereabouts of Philboyd, she might know where Baptiste is, too.
Jotsu nodded. He drew the girl away from Nora and gently lifted her tear-streaked face by a finger under her chin, a gesture sharply reminiscent of Ayn and Alf Thoroldsen.
What are you really doing out here, child?
I seek the warlord, General Jotsu.
Why?
My mother told me that if anything happened to her, to the Holy City, then I could rely on the help of only one man, my father.
The reaction of Jotsu surprised Kane. His face remained completely immobile and inscrutable, with not so much as the lifting of an eyebrow. Nora's eyes darted from his face to Kumudvati's.
Of course, it makes sense now.
Kane, standing to one side of the girl and the man, studied their profiles and was struck by the strong resemblance, particularly around the chin and mouth. But he had no inclination to stand around idly waiting for Jotsu to process the information.
I need to know about Brewster.
Slowly, reluctantly, Kumudvati removed her gaze from Jotsu's face and fixed it upon Kane.
He is a prisoner in Angkor Thom. I heard about him coming from a foreign land and that he might have scientific knowledge. I spoke with him yesterday. Colonel Puyong followed me to his cell and became angry, fearful of what he might have told me. Even though I explained that Busta told me nothing, the colonel did not believe me because he does not speak the English. Against my wishes, he will execute Busta today. I realized that the colonel is mad, so I took the Vimana to find General Jotsu and plead for his help as my mother instructed. I saw the Vimana of the Cobra Guard, and I tried to hide from them, but instead, I caused the vehicle to crash.
You weren't injured?
No. I managed to jump clear before it caught on fire, and then came the dragon.
There was no one else with Brewster? A tall woman with red hair and green eyes?
No, only him.
Kumudvati returned her penetrating gaze to Jotsu's face.
You are him, aren't you? The general?
I am he, princess.
The girl ducked her head almost reverently, crossing her forearms over her jewel-laden bosom.
I put myself and the empire into your hands. I am the issue of the mingled essence of the Devi Naga and her enemy, the warlord of Phnom Kule. I am the living expression of the Sudarshana Chakra, and I need your guidance, Father.
The Vimana dropped gently down through the labyrinth of trees. Branches of incredible breadth crossed and twined, forming pathways of wood, leaf, and vine. The Vimana cruised among them, like a feather floating down a stream. Brigid Baptiste peered through the bubble canopy, amazed at how skillfully and gracefully Brother Javalara piloted the ship through the thickets. Clouds of tiny gnats and midges swirled in the shafts of sunlight slanting down through the roof formed by the great trees. Here and there fell blankets of cool, leaf-edged shadow. In the shaded places, monkeys and gibbons dozed, then shrieked and fled at the sight of the craft invading their arboreal refuge. A huge reticulated python, looking almost big enough to crush the Vimana, coiled its body around a tree limb as the vessel eased past.
This is about the best way to sneak into enemy territory I ever heard of.
I still have grave misgivings, Baptiste.
You can always drop me off and let me fend for myself.
No. When you outlined your idea, I told you I would help you, because the friend you want to rescue is also a great scientist.
I never claimed to be a scientist, great or otherwise. Brewster Philboyd most definitely is.
I am beginning to regret that I agreed to this. But you are a very persuasive woman. I just hate putting such a brain as yours at risk in a chancy undertaking like this one.
I guarantee you that I'll safeguard my brain so the Devinaga and Colonel Puyang won't be getting their hands on it before you do.
Javalara threw her a sour smile over his shoulder.
That comforts me, Baptiste.
The flight from the hiding place of the Vimana to the outskirts of Angkor Thom had been surprisingly short, less than an hour. Once Javalara agreed to the rescue attempt, Yasovar elected to remain behind. He put the interphaser aboard and operated the mechanism which opened a hatch in the roof of the hut. The Vimana had risen vertically into the sky as smoothly as if pulled by a celestial magnet. Javalara extended the craft's wings, and the little cruiser shot over the vast vista of the jungle like an arrow loosed from a bow. Brigid didn't understand the system of aerodynamics at work. Although she heard the drone of some type of motor within a rear compartment, Javalara also claimed he controlled the Vimana through a mental interaction with its mechanical motive power. He made a cryptic comment about utilizing a gravity-negative or gravity-repellent pressure. Brigid knew of Einstein's studies in the field of electromagnetism and gravity, referring to them as the cosmological constant. The theory dealt with a form of anti-gravity, what he called a quintessence. To Brigid's frustration, Javalara's concentration was such that he could not afford to be distracted to address technical questions. She speculated that the pilot of the Vimana, in tandem with the motor, could alter the gravitation constant of the craft sufficiently to keep it airborne. She had witnessed feats of psychokinesis before, so she guessed a variation of that ability was at work with the Vimana. When the aircraft entered the jungle, Javalara retracted the wings, and the ship nosed its way carefully among the trees until he brought it to rest within the fork of a huge fig tree. Through the screen of leaves, Brigid glimpsed pinnacled towers. Releasing his pent-up breath, Javalara massaged his temples.
Ah, it's been some time since I've flown. It can be a strain.
We were a long time in the air.
Not long enough. The longer one is airborne in a Vimana, the easier the piloting becomes. The more the part of the mind that controls the Vimana is exercised, the easier the process becomes, like strengthening a muscle. Now, let's see what we can see.
Javalara gestured for Brigid to precede him, and she squirmed down into the crotch of the great tree. Cautiously, she walked out onto a bough three times the thickness of her body. She and Javalara walked to a point on the gigantic limb where they both had a fairly unobstructed view of Angkor Thom.
Behold the holy city of the Khmer Empire.
The towers and spires looked about close enough to touch. The architecture was more than impressive. It was magnificent. But Brigid had matters of greater weight on her mind than the construction techniques of an ancient civilization. She spied some small, well-tended fields on the northern outskirts of the city. The early afternoon sun shone bright and hot, but the streets were crowded with people. They moved toward a circular courtyard, ringed by tall, smooth stones engraved with smiling Buddha faces. From the center rose a high gallows. She counted five nooses dangling from the cross timber. The people marching toward the scaffold looked thin and weary. The few clothes they wore were threadbare. They didn't speak among themselves. Brigid received the distinct impression they didn't feel attending a mass execution was an enjoyable way to break up their day. Here and there she saw men in gray-green uniforms and polished helmets fashioned to resemble the heads of cobras. With gun barrels, they nudged the procession of people toward the courtyard.
How long do we have?
No more than an hour. They've got the prisoners locked up in that building. See it?
Brigid followed his finger to a stone structure rising from the far side of the courtyard like a gray wart. Shading her eyes, she saw five of the serpent-helmeted men standing sentry around it.
Three in front, two in back. If we hit the rear of the place first, we've only got two to worry about right off the bat.
You seem very sure of yourself, Baptiste. Have you done something like this before?
Brigid repressed a wry grin as she recalled all the hairbreadth escapes and rescues she had been involved in over the past couple of years.
You might say I'm somewhat experienced at this sort of thing.
You might be, but I am quite the novice in matters of violence, especially against trained soldiers. Just our attempt to free the prisoners, regardless of its success, will alert every Cobra guard in the city, on and off duty. We won't be able to enter the palace unseen.
Now, I seriously doubt the Cobra Guard will expect us to dash into the palace. More than likely, they'll cordon off all the ways out of the city.
Well, that is true, but still...
You know your way around Angkor Thom, right? It's your home, isn't it?
Of course. I've lived there for over 20 years, back when most of the buildings hadn't been restored.
Well, in that case, your knowledge of the city is our most valuable asset. You can tell us the best places to hide once we spring the prisoners, and how to get into Angkor Wat undetected.
Nervously, Javalara stroked his goatee.
How do I know that once you have freed your friend, you won't just use your interfacer to return to this Cerberus of yours?
First of all, I've given you my word I'll help you. Secondarily, even after I free Dr. Filboid, I still won't have retrieved Dr. Penick. If she's been captured by the warlord Jotsu, then I'll need your help to free her. Also, I'm very interested in seeing the essence of the Naga phenomena for myself.
So we may die trying to free your friend, but at least I can expire knowing you intended to keep your word.
It's better than nothing, isn't it?
That's debatable.
He and Brigid returned to the Vimana. She waited below in the fork of the tree while he crawled back aboard and handed her down the saddlebag. Swiftly, she stripped out of her still-damp sari and began pulling on the shadow suit by opening a magnetic seal on its right side. The garment had no zippers or buttons, and she put it on in one continuous piece from the hard-soled boots to the gloves. The fabric molded itself to her body, adhering like another layer of epidermis. She smoothed out the wrinkles and folds by running her hands over arms and legs. She didn't care if Javalara peeked at her or not. She had learned the hard way that modesty was a variable, an artifice. Pulling herself back up into the Vimana, she realized she felt about 10 times better, particularly after the suit's internal thermostats cooled her.
Javalara, get us as close to the gallows and the Hoosgow as you can.
The what?
Where the prisoners are being held. I'd prefer a rooftop.
I'll do my best, Baptiste. I just hope it's enough.
The Vimana slid through the forest canopy, collecting a camouflaging mat of vines and branches in the process. The ship stayed close to the shadowing trees as it circled Angkor Thom, coming around from the north end, which was essentially farmland and unrestored ruins. The cruiser skimmed the surface of a reservoir, almost skating along like a water beetle. The edges were clogged and overgrown with vegetation. The vine-draped Vimana looked like one more clump of foliage to the casual glance, or at least Brigid and Javalara hoped that was the case. The Magicker brought the Vimana to rest in an overgrown irrigation canal. He and Brigid disembarked, although they got wet in the process. Auto pistol in hand, she followed Javalara on a circuitous route along alleys, side streets, over tumble-down blocks of stone, and through empty temple galleries. She resisted the impulse to examine the elaborate carvings and statues. They turned down a cross street flanked by stone townhouses on whose flat roofs blossomed gardens. Narrow lanes cut between them. Beyond and above rose even higher structures than those that surrounded the temple complex of Angkor Wat. Javalara and Brigid reached the rear of a 3-story flat-roofed building very near the courtyard, but an old man sat outside it on a stool. Stripped to the waist, his skin was the texture and color of cured leather. He industriously cleaned fish with a small knife. A heap of guts drew flies on his right. Brigid and Javalara drew back into the shadows cast by an overhang, crouching behind a crumbling wall.
Maybe he'll go inside if it gets too hot.
He should be attending the executions.
As if on cue, a thick-set member of the Cobra Guard marched around the corner.
Execution day, Grandfather. Your wrinkled ass is required in the square.
I know. But today I was lucky with my nets. Today I and my family will eat, unlike the last 3 days.
Are you criticizing the benevolence of the Devinaga?
I am saying my family will eat today. I did not bring her glory into the discussion at all.
You might eat, but only after you witnessed the executions of enemies of her glory.
I have already witnessed a number of executions of her enemies. My belly is not interested in seeing more.
The snake-helmeted man calmly strode over to the old man.
You don't seem to understand, Grandfather. The Devinaga insist you attend, so that you may see what happens to enemies of the Khmer Empire.
The old man probed the inside of his cheek with his tongue. He looked down at the knife in his hand, then eyed the Cobra Guardsman. Brigid could tell he seriously contemplated driving the knife into the man's chest. The soldier knew it too, and smirked at him contemptuously, silently daring him to make an attempt to stab him. He hefted his sub-gun suggestively. At length, the old man turned his head, spat a jet of blood toward the heap of fish entrails, and stood. jamming the knife into the wooden stool.
Let us go. I do not wish to disappoint her glory.
Or die, grandfather. Do not forget that part of it.
Grabbing the man by the back of the neck, the smirking soldier shoved him around the corner of the building, delivering a kick to his rear to speed him along. Bridget's finger crooked reflexively around the trigger of the TP-9, and her thumb touched the safety switch. She clenched her teeth while she struggled to contain her anger. Javalara touched her arm and shook his head. She nodded impatiently, acknowledging her companion's rebuke, realizing that even a single gunshot would be heard by the Cobra Guard attending the execution. When the old man and the soldier were completely out of sight, she and Javalara crept out of the shadows and scaled the building. The many bas-relief carvings provided adequate hand and footholds. They climbed quickly to the roof, crawling to the edge, looking at the rear of the scaffold and the round stone hut. Bridget estimated that 20 or so yards of open ground lay between them. The two guards leaned against the building, conversing idly, their subguns dangling carelessly from shoulder straps. But even as torpid as they appeared in the afternoon heat, Bridget knew they would easily see her approach.
What now?
Bridget scrutinized the buildings around the courtyard, noting how it was filling up fast with people.
We need some kind of distraction.
Javalara looked apprehensively at the towers looming above them.
Someone could look out a window, perhaps the Devi Naga herself, see us and raise an alarm. That might work.
Oh, you're not only a scientist, but a comedian. You're not being very helpful.
Well, you're the one who claimed you had experience at this sort of thing.
Bridget fought down a swell of hopelessness, as well as a surge of self-directed anger. She knew if Kane and Grant had been present, they would have concocted half a dozen scenarios by now. Almost all the possible courses of action flitting through her mind ended the same way, with Brewster Filboid hanging from a rope with a broken neck, and she and Javalara shot dead. She glared at the scaffold and the stone holding cell. The sun drove a nail of pain into the back of her head, and she slitted her eyes against the shimmer of heat waves rising from the paving stones. Javalara suddenly pointed skyward. Looking up, shielding her eyes with a hand, Bridget scanned the limitless blue. Movement caught her attention, sunlight flashing on metal. Her belly flip-flopped when she spied the silver Vimana cruising over the treetops. She recognized the craft as the same one that had buzzed them earlier that day.
The Vimana of the Cobra Guard! They will see us! There's no way they cannot!
Bridget silently agreed with the man's assessment. With her black shadow suit, she was as conspicuous as an ink stain on a tablecloth.
Get off the roof and blend in with the crowd. I'll draw their attention.
No. Even if I manage to get away, the main problem will remain. The essence of the Naga will still be in imbalance. Nothing will change.
Not very pragmatic, but thank you.
Bridget kept her gaze fixed on the Vimana. The nose of the winged craft turned in their direction.
All right, we're spotted. What do you want to do, surrender or make a fight of it?
Javalara's response, if he had one, was smothered by the crash of static filling her head. She winced, biting back a cry of surprise.
What kind of party are you dressed up for, Baptiste? And why wasn't I invited?
Bridget stared in mute astonishment at the Vimana, and then her face lightened, relief washing over her in such a wave she grew weak. She laid her head down on her crossed forearms.
We can't stay here. The Vimana is
carrying the distraction we need. His name is Kane, and it's about time he got here.